Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm today joined here in Berlin at the Asia-Europe Economic Forum by three scholars from, in fact, the two largest countries in the world. I think together they represent well over 2.5 billion people populating this planet. The three scholars are, on my left, Professor He Fan from the Shanghai Jiao Tong University. Professor He, welcome.
Thank you.
To my right is Dr. Ying Gu, Director of the Center for Rising Powers and Global Development at the Brighton Institute for Development Studies. Welcome, Dr. Gu.
Thank you, Guchang.
And last but not least, Suman Berry from Bruegel.
Thanks, Guntram.
So we are having this conference on Asia-Europe connectivity and infrastructure investment here in Berlin together with our partners. And one of the big topics is, of course, the Belt and Road Initiative, the major investments into infrastructure, but also into connectivity that China has been undertaking. The Belt and Road Initiative is now, well, almost 6 years old and has been met with a lot of welcoming words, but also with quite some criticism. And here today, I want to discuss with you and hear from you, what is your perspective? What's perhaps first the stock taking? Where are we in this major strategy of President Xi? Of course, we want to then also hear from the Indian perspective. What is India's perspective on the Belt and Road Initiative, which I think is more skeptical than the Chinese perspective. And I will not shy away from also giving perhaps one or two comments from a European point of view. Dr. Professor He, I start with you. You've been looking at this project also for many years, perhaps more from a macroeconomic point of view, from a financing point of view, but why don't you give us a short, and our listeners, a short introduction into the subject?
Okay. So BRI means Road and Belt Initiative. So it was proposed by Chinese government about 6 years ago. And it is also, you know, not very controversial, but also, you know, in China we have different opinions, and you can see that this policy is keep evolving. The very concept of Road and Belt Initiative, if you compare that with 5 years ago, 6 years ago, is not exactly the same. So I would like to say at the early stage, what the Chinese government was thinking is a Chinese proposal. And because we learn from our experience that if you spend more money building all kinds of infrastructure, and it will facilitate economic development. So we try to share our experience with other developing countries. And recently, I think a better way to understand what a Road and Belt Initiative is, it is sort of a platform. So we invite other countries that this is a Chinese, not a Chinese strategy, but a Chinese proposal. So if you like it, and then you can work together with China. And so that's, I think, down the track, what we can see, that this is a changing concept and a changing vision.
So if I may, an important aspect is, of course, that infrastructure investment helps development. And you work at the, of course, an Institute for Development Studies. So perhaps you can shed some light on the aspect of development. I mean, there's development outside of China, but there's also the question, is this actually helpful to develop the west of China, the more backward, the less developed parts of China?
Yes, the Belt and Road Initiative is called the project of the century. It's the largest development finance project in the world. So around the world, obviously, Belt and Road Initiative offers a huge potential for global development. But on the other hand, it raises lots of concerns about the potential environmental, social, and even political risks in those Belt and Road countries. Because, you know, when you look at those Belt and Road countries, most of them are very poor developing countries. So what's the implication of this? What's the nature of the Belt and Road Initiative? Is it just a big trade and investment project, or is it about global development? It's a development plan. There's a big difference between those two. I think 5 years ago, you know, when people talk about Belt and Road Initiative, especially in China, the focus was very much on the economic aspects of Belt and Road Initiative. Even for some officials, it wasn't a development plan, wasn't about global development or global public goods. But in the recent 3 years, especially, you know, and the pressure from the international community, the Chinese government is adjusting the definition and also approach of the Belt and Road Initiative. So we heard about, there were lots of talks around high quality infrastructure and comply with international standards and also global common destiny and prosperity, etc. So we heard a lot of those kind of comments at the second high level Belt and Road Forum in Beijing last April. So the original definition and the approach of Belt and Road Initiative have evolved over the last 5 years. And China is on a steep learning curve about this big initiative. And so we have an opportunity to help China to reshape this, important initiative. So I think, you know, we have an opportunity to actually work with not just the Chinese government, but also the Chinese business and NGOs to help to reshape this initiative. But the fundamental question is, you know, we have to define what's the nature of this initiative. Is it about development? Is it about global public goods?
Well, Professor He, let me come back to you. One issue is, of course, that China still has a very high savings rate. I think more than 40%, perhaps 45% of GDP is being saved, and domestic investments have often gone bad or been less productive. And there's a lot of non-performing loans. Now, can one understand Belt and Road Initiative as an initiative to channel excess savings perhaps into neighboring countries where the return on investment is still higher?
Well, at the early stages, some scholars and also including some government officials think this is a good way that maybe China has excessive capacity and then we can transfer that to other country. But then gradually they realize that it is very difficult because the environment in other countries are quite different from that in China. So now they are more emphasizing on the coordination of policies and then people-to-people connectivity, things like that. And from China's viewpoint, infrastructure building really changed the landscape of Chinese economy. Well, there is some good thing and also some bad things. And good thing is now if even you travel to some very remote area in China, you can see the infrastructure has been improved substantially. You can see the newly paved roads everywhere, and high-speed railway is connecting the coastal area to inland area. But at the same time, some I have to say some infrastructure building project turned out to be a fiasco, because what matters is not the supply of infrastructure. What matters is the demand of infrastructure. So you can imagine that if you increase infrastructure investment in the more advanced area in China, that's the coastal area, eastern area, and then the benefit will be larger. But then if you, for example, you build a road in the desert leading to nowhere, and then definitely that money will be wasted. And I think other countries can also learn those experience as well as lessons from China.
Okay, Suman, you're based in New Delhi. You're a non-resident fellow at Bruegel. You've lived a lot in Europe. You know, I think, the global landscape very well, but of course also you know the Indian perspective on this very well. India is, of course, the giant next to China, and is not participating in the Belt and Road Initiative, but many neighboring countries are. There's lots of infrastructure building in neighboring countries, I think, including in Pakistan, but also, of course, more south of China, south of India, southeast of India. Tell us a bit your the way you perceive the debate in New Delhi on the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, Guntram. So I'll speak as a Bruegel fellow and as a global economist who has, spent a considerable period of time at the World Bank, whose business is infrastructure lending. And then I'll try and represent the Indian point of view. Just to pick up on what my colleagues have said, I think the world needs, the developing world needs infrastructure. There has, as Professor Goh said, been a collective learning experience in the aid business and about infrastructure worldwide, which is to say that, quite while I was even at the World Bank, a lot of infrastructure, bilateral aid programs had tied aid, and then they moved to untied aid. The British were in the forefront of that, transparency, etc. And I take the point that China is going down this journey and is learning fast, okay? So that there were some initial mistakes. Let me just say two things. One is, to the extent that this is a use of Chinese savings, and it's not clear to me how much it is, then the Chinese people themselves have an important stake in making sure that these projects are viable, okay? And we know what happened when Japan started to invest in trophy projects in the 1980s and real estate in Manhattan, etc., all of which crashed. So seen from the point of view of an aging population in China, to the fact that you have a saving surplus now is not a reason for misallocating it. So seen from the point of view of China and the globe, we all have an interest in making sure that these savings are well deployed, because, as they have said, this is on a global scale, this what we're talking about. Now to come to the concerns of India, which were expressed very sharply in 2017, right before the first Belt and Road Forum. I think it was April 2017. Whereas the Belt and Road is both lateral into Europe, which is what we'll be discussing a lot here, and southward into Southeast Asia and into Pakistan, India has been particularly focused on the latter. Okay, and two dimensions particularly colored the Indian view. One was the fact that over and above the military support that China has given to Pakistan, Pakistan was going to be a major beneficiary, which would have meant And that has meant, actually, Chinese troops to guard Chinese labor, you know, coming into a disputed area of Kashmir. This was one. Secondly, there was a famous project in Sri Lanka, the port development of Hambantota, which was where the contract was signed under a previous government, and it was unviable. And so what was debt finance turned into, in effect, ownership of a strategic. And so India started to become concerned that debt financing was being seen as a way of acquiring strategic assets in various parts of the world. And so India's reasons for opting out were that the standards of transparency that the world has insisted on in other infrastructure ought to be applied here too, because otherwise this was not fair for the countries that were receiving it. And indeed, we have seen, for example, when there's been a change of regime in the case of Malaysia, that Prime Minister Mahathir went to Beijing to renegotiate some of these things. There are also murmurs coming out of Pakistan under the Imran Khan government that the terms on which the Belt and Road loans have been contracted are infeasible. One final point, which is relevant to the G20, there is also very much in infrastructure circles at the moment the idea that infrastructure should be green infrastructure. And yet, including in Pakistan, a substantial part of the investment program under the Belt and Road consists of thermal power plants. And, you know, I think we can all take different views on whether this is right or not, but certainly some of the critics, not in India and not in China, but in third countries, including Europe, are worried that, you know, about this.
Well, thank you, Suman. I think, of course, very differentiated view and also very much emphasizing the benefits, the upside of this, but also some of the worries, including when it comes to the question of the debt trap, the famous debt trap. Will countries be over-indebted and as a result lose strategic assets? But also the environmental concerns. But I think, Suman, you also emphasized quite fairly that China is learning also. At the beginning, its policies, development aid policies have been less clear and less advanced and less, let's say, differentiated and up to the norms. Dr. Gu, we had a discussion on sort of what are good standards for development aid and, you know, how China is learning and how it is applying those in the Belt and Road Initiative. Perhaps you want to react to some of the things you just heard from Suman?
Yeah, I think definitely the Belt and Road Initiative has huge potential to contribute to the SDGs and global development. But meanwhile, it's least institutionalized the initiative or integration initiative. So how to institutionalize the Belt and Road Initiative and how to, you know, connect the Belt and Road Initiative with other, you know, development plan. So Belt and Road Initiative is not just the online game right now at a global level. There are many, you know, similar initiatives. So how to connect the different initiatives? In the international standards is one of the critical issues, especially in those Belt and Road countries. So on international standards, I think there's different opinions, different perspectives on what constitutes international standards. It will very much, you know, depend on the country, and also we need to work it case by case and not just, you know, give an oversimplified answer like we need to comply with the international standards. But we need to, you know, understand the best standards is not actually the international standard. It's the international it's very much the standard which, you know, suitable to the local conditions, can promote, you know, the development in that region. That could be called the best standards. So let's leave this, the division about the international standards or the Chinese standards or the European standards aside. Let's focus on what's the best standards for the local community in those Belt and Road countries.
Well, perhaps just to say, from a European point of view, of course, there is a big worry that lending done in an intransparent way from China makes it much more difficult for European institutions to actually lend to specific countries, because there's much less clarity on the actual debt situation, on the claims, on the legal framework under which China has lent money. And so this is one big worry in the European Union, that this will undermine the possibility for the EU to do development aid. I think the other big worry from a European point of view is that Belt and Road Initiative is not a multilateral endeavor, but very much a China-centric endeavor, and that as a consequence there might be a trade diversion away from European countries. And the last perhaps worry from a European point of view is that this initiative might be used in a strategic way in certain parts of Europe's periphery to the detriment of integration between the EU and those peripheral countries in the EU. On the latter point, I have to admit there's also certainly a big question what the EU can do and can offer in its own neighborhood, be it Northern Macedonia, the Balkans, Albania, but be it also countries like Ukraine or even Northern Africa. I mean, this in a sense is the EU's backyard, and I think there's certainly a role that the EU has to play, and perhaps a bigger role that the EU has to play. I think we are coming to an end. I want to give a short final sentence the microphone to each of you, and then we wrap it up, and perhaps we start again with Suman, and then in reverse order. Then we have Dr. Gu and then Professor He.
Oh, simply to say, Guntram, that we are talking of the largest economy in the world. I think back to Victorian England and the way in which the whole infrastructure that supported Victorian England was built up, the Suez Canal, the railways of the Pampas, etc., all of which were central to the development of a global economy at that time around London. So I think the notion that, China, as the largest economy, would want to support infrastructure of that kind, perhaps centered on it, strikes me as reasonable. So the issues are of transparency, and because we're no longer in a colonial era, local ownership.
We are, living in an era full of uncertainties. And there are lots of global development challenges. But meanwhile, this provides an opportunity for all of us to work together, and rather than, emphasizing competition and confrontation. Those are not the way forward. We do have to work together to try to strengthen our multilateral regimes and to try to find a solution at the global level. We need to strengthen the global governance.
Yeah, I'm concerned with Guntram's concern. I think international development is one potential area that China and other countries, including EU, should cooperate with each other. But first, we have to recognize the comparative advantage from both sides. And I think the comparative advantage for China is we have a vivid memory of how you can change from a poor country to a relatively middle-income country. If you take a time machine to China to the year 1980, and by hindsight, you can see there's a very good investment opportunity. But at that time, there's few foreign companies want to invest in China because, you know, all kinds of problems right now. But because in China in the last three and four decades, and we have went through this very rapid social development. So there is some experience that I think China can understand better than rich countries like European country and the United States. But the comparative disadvantage of China is a newcomer in this area. And the Chinese company, they are more familiar with the quick money that they can learn in Chinese market. And then in the international governance, and Chinese government is also a newcomer. So in that area, and probably there's more issues that we can exchange view and then to improve the whole system.
Well, yes, indeed. There's much more to talk about, but I certainly very much take the point, Jinggu and Hufan, that there is much to collaborate on. And I think the objective also of our Asia-Europe Economic Forum is to be a forum of dialogue, of better understanding, which I think is quite crucial in a time where we risk really having a significant bipolarization of the world with significant tensions between the United States and China, leaving the European Union and many Asian countries really in an impossible situation. So I very much think it's a very important wish that we find ways of establishing good collaboration that in the end we don't get trapped in a geopolitical confrontation based on high standards, on learning from each other and cooperation. And I think that is perhaps a nice word to end this conversation on. Well, as you said, the biggest development, recent development initiative in the world. Suman, Ying, Fan, thank you so much for the discussion we've had today. And please join us again at our podcast next week. Bye-bye.